I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
What do you want to watch?
Can't really do another true crime.
What about?
Oh my God. She even has your hair.
The first question any platform is going to ask is, what's the hook?
The first step is to recognize that you're not in control of this.
That's Salma Hayek?
Bingo.
Hello, everyone. It's me, David Chen, here at Decoding TV. We're back after an extremely brief hiatus, and we have an exciting few episodes in store for you because we're going to be covering Black Mirror here at Decoding TV on the podcast and on the YouTube channel at youtube.com/decodingTV, where we're broadcasting live right now. Joining me for this journey, she is a TV critic at Vulture.com. She also joined me previously for our recap of The White Lotus, which we all had a blast with. Roxana Haddadi, welcome back to Decoding TV.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm sad we won't have like a very in-depth discussion about whether like sex work is good or bad with these episodes.
Who knows? We haven't finished watching Black Mirror yet, so maybe.
Who can say?
But yes, over the course of the next couple weeks, Roxana Haddadi and I will be releasing three episodes covering Black Mirror Season 6. So the idea is that this episode is Black Mirror Season 6 Episodes 1 and 2, Joan is Awful, and Locke Henry. We're going to do one episode just covering Beyond the Sea, and then we will have another episode covering the last two episodes, Episodes 4 and 5. So, and it will be coming out in the next couple weeks, basically. So we'll kind of try to space them out a little bit. Got a lot of other stuff coming out, too, here on Decoding TV. You should be looking forward to coverage of The Bear, which is releasing in a week or so, as well. The whole season's being dumped on Hulu. We'll probably do a This Week in Streaming to cover that. And Silo is ending in a couple weeks as well, so you can look forward to that. And there may or may not be one other show that is in the mix. So be sure to stay tuned to podcast.decodingtv.com to get updates when that happens. You can also sign up for our email list at decodingtv.com. Follow us on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok at Decoding TV. But yeah, I do want to mention Decoding TV exists and is able to continue because of paid subscribers at decodingtv.com. So if you could become a free or paid subscriber, we'd really, really appreciate it. Again, that's at decodingtv.com. All right. Roxana Haddadi, before we get into like these specific episodes, Joan is Awful and Locke Henry, let's talk for like a couple minutes about our overall thoughts on Black Mirror and our thoughts like going into this season, right? What's your, when before you watch these episodes, when I say the words Black Mirror, what are the connotations that come to mind?
That's a good question. I don't know if I can easily think of connotations, but I think my relationship with Black Mirror is like very mixed. Like I sort of respect the anthology style. I mean, I love the anthology style, right? Like Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities, I was a big fan. I think you get a lot of freedom thematically and narratively with this format. I just think Black Mirror itself is like very mixed to me. Sometimes it feels edgy just to be edgy, and I don't necessarily think there is a grander point to it than just let me throw in this narrative swerve that is bloody or gross or shocking or whatever. But I also like how critical it can be of the status quo. I think that's sci-fi's like greatest power. And in this season, we sort of move away from that genre into other genres, which we can talk about like how effective that is. But yeah, so I have a very up and down relationship with this show. And when I heard that there are more episodes, I think I was like, oh, okay, let's see how those go. I don't think I was immediately excited, but I wasn't immediately skeptical. I was immediately curious, which also is more than you can say about a lot of shows, right? So I was curious going.
We got to give a shout out to Netflix's marketing team. I thought they put together an amazing trailer for Black, or a series of trailers for Black Mirror season 6. There are big stars in Black Mirror season 6. Aaron Paul, Selma Hayek, Pinot, Josh Hartnett. Like these are
Hartnett is a big star.
Now we are in the middle of a Hartnessance.
Are we?
Okay. I guess spoken by someone who hasn't seen Operation Fortune Ruse de Guerre.
I was going to say,
I mean, side note, I think Josh Hartnett looks awesome. Like, he just is like, he's aged very well, in my opinion.
Okay.
doesn't do it for Roxana. It does it for me. That's fine.
That's fine.
We don't always, we don't all need to feel the same way about Josh Hartnett. But, I thought they put together a great, intriguing trailer for season 6. Like that's a trailer that if you had no idea what Black Mirror was, you watch that trailer, it's like, oh, that's I want to check that out.
Right.
I largely agree. I think there's very few people for whom Black Mirror has not been a very up and down, hit or miss experience.
Yeah.
That seems, most of the people I talk with, it's like, yeah, it's really had its ups and downs. And there have been some great episodes and some terrible episodes. Most of the episodes are sad. Most of the episodes have a really downer ending. I think probably only two episodes that come to mind have anywhere even close to a positive ending. One of which being San Junipero, you know, like a classic.
Which is like everyone's beloved episode.
Yeah. Great episode of television. Mm-hmm. So at its worst, it's like iPad's bad, you know, like it's like, oh, any new technology is evil and bad. It's very unsubtle and nuanced. At its best, it allowed us to think about the complex trade-offs that technology creates in our lives. What do we get? What do we give up? And that is what I hope for when I watch episodes of Black Mirror, is like, you make me think about, what do we get? What do we give up? Hopefully you make me laugh. Hopefully you make me think. Probably you're going to make me sad. That's kind of what I look for in the best of Black Mirror. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about these episodes one by one. And Roxana and I will offer like brief thoughts on whether you should watch it. Then we are going to spoil that episode. I will read a detailed recap of that episode. And then we will kind of dive into more specific elements of the episode. So that's what we're going to do today. We'll do it one by one. Today we're going to be covering episodes one and two. Let's start with episode one. Very strong offering, in my opinion. Joan is awful. First episode of season 6 of Black Mirror. Roxana Haddadi, let's start by talking about whether you think people should watch this episode. Is it any good?
I think it's good. I don't think it's great. But I think to everything you just said about what Black Mirror does, I think this episode gives you a primer about what the series is about, right? It's about like, what do you abandon about yourself in this current day and age? Like, what rights do you give up? There's a very, I thought, funny segment about the terms and conditions that we all scroll through whenever we accept a new app or something like that. So I think the episode really is clear with this sort of like warning about what tech can do. It lost me a little bit at the end, which I think got a little bit too convoluted. But I think this is good. A solid intro to Black Mirror. If you haven't seen the 5 preceding seasons, I think this is a good way to understand what the show is about. What about you?
I really like this one. You know, I think I saw someone describe it as Charlie Kaufman light. And I think that's right. I would agree that it's mind bending and weird and uncomfortable and interesting and funny. Agreed that it does get pretty complicated. It basically at the last like 10 minutes of this episode throws in like 5 new ideas, but it doesn't take it too seriously. I think it's being a little bit cheeky towards the end and just being like, hey, maybe think about this too. But overall, I thought it was great. It is, I think, not necessarily the best Black Mirror episode or one of the best, but it is like very strong. This is like, hey, this is about technology that we are actually dealing with today, kind of prescient, I would argue. Like, we have AI generated, you know, movies and TV shows and songs happening right now. But like, I have to imagine it was a little bit less developed than it is today when they were shooting this. And so, so I appreciate like the kind of foresight. And that's another thing that I should have mentioned in the preamble is, Black Mirror has, despite all its flaws, often called a lot of things that actually happen in real life. A lot of like elements of real life, you know, sci-fi inventions that have actually come to pass since Black Mirror aired, events that have come to pass since Black Mirror aired. Season one in particular had some very prescient political developments that I think real life resembles. So I quite like this one. I would like really feel comfortable recommending this episode to anyone, Black Mirror fan or not. Just a decent, solid episode of sci-fi. So that's our overall thoughts on Joan is Awful. Let's talk about what actually happened in the episode. When Joan is Awful begins, our protagonist Joan is... and for some reason, the whole recap just vanished in front of me.
Oh, no!
But it's back now.
Do you want me to read it?
It's back. No, I got it.
Okay.
I think it was like a... versioning control thing. When Joan is Awful begins, our protagonist Joan is living a fairly ordinary life. She's a team leader at a tech company called Sonicle, where we see she has to deal with the unfortunate task of laying off one of her employees. She goes to therapy and complains about her bland relationship with her fiance, Krish. Later that night, she meets with an ex-boyfriend and considers rekindling their romance. But when Joan arrives home, she and Krish decide to watch a new show on a Streamberry service, like a Netflix-esque service called Streamberry, called Joan is Awful. It stars Selma Hayek-Pino as Joan, and we see Selma act out every detail of Joan's day in graphic detail and for everyone to see, including Joan's friends and family. We later learn that Streamberry is actually using a CG recreation of Selma Hayek-Pino to make the show on a daily basis. As the show continues night after night, exposing all the details of Joan's life, Joan realizes that the show is ruining her life and also ruining Selma Hayek-Pino's public image. So she takes matters into her own hands. She teams up with Selma to infiltrate Streamberry and destroy the quantum computer that's been powering the show. End quote. I don't know why I say end quote. I wrote that. So it's my
turn.
I'm just
quoting yourself.
I'm programmed to say end quote when I'm reading something. So that's kind of what happens for the plot of Joan is Awful. And I want to start by saying I am impressed by how much of at least the first two episodes is very anti-Netflix, in my opinion.
Are you impressed by that? I don't know if I'm impressed by, like, cashing Netflix checks and then being like, Netflix is bad. Like, come on.
It's kind of subversive.
Is it? I think it would be subversive if then you, like, donated the money or something. Like, I just...
Charlie Brooker needs a new deck on his house, Roxana.
Does he? I feel like he probably has a lot of decks. Like, I feel like this has been a successful show. I don't know. There's something about that that feels very... I can both acknowledge the fact that it's like, cool, you took a stand, I guess. But I also think it just feels hypocritical to me.
To be working.
I come from the school of like all selling out is bad. I haven't evolved my politics since being a teenager. So.
You're like Gen. Yeah, Roxana's not even a millennial. She's Gen X, apparently, from what I'm learning.
Apparently, yeah. Yes, no longer elder millennial. I'm just going to tack some years onto my life.
You're going to go all the way back to Gen X.
But they do. It is very, you're right. It is very Netflix like. It's the same bold red font. The same like rainbow bars before a program starts playing.
Yeah, toxic take on Netflix. It's a very like Netflix is bad for society take.
Sure.
Which I really, you know, hey, I honestly don't care how you're making the point. And even if you're being paid well by Netflix for it, as long as the point is being made, I think good is being done for society. So it's funny to kind of see all the little Netflix references. Also, like, I don't know if you freeze framed like I did some of the other shows that they were considering watching. But one of them was called The Callow Years, which is referenced later on in the show. So like when Joan and Krish are like deciding what to watch. They like page through a bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was called The Callow Years.
Mm-hmm.
And this
that
is
comes
the
up in episode two.
It comes up in episode two as well. This is the description of The Callow Years that's okay. on the TV in the fake stream, fake Netflix Streamberry streaming service. A fascinating six-part documentary exploration of the prime ministership of Michael Callow, including never-before-seen archival footage from some of his most controversial public moments, end quote. I have to say that sounds pretty boring, and I think that's kind of what the what they were going for is like
mm-hmm.
they're going for a boring sounding name, a boring description, and then like just not a bad documentary, just like not something that's like wide interest.
But then that doesn't align with me with what Netflix does, which is makes very like sensational, over dramatized documentaries, right?
I think they do a little bit of everything. But
I would have laughed more if it was like a Tiger King joke. Like I still think Tiger King is the apex of the worst documentary style that comes to Netflix. But there's a lot of like reporting about this, right? About how like Netflix has specifically like shaped and also destroyed what the doc genre has been for a long time.
Yeah.
So there is reporting on that if people are interested in reading it. Yeah. But yeah, so what else did you like about this episode aside from the Netflix poking of it all?
Yeah. So I think it introduces like a bunch of ideas and some of them are compelling and mm-hmm. some of them aren't.
Okay.
I'll start with the ones that aren't like there was one season. I remember there being like one season of Netflix where I think it was last season or the one before where every episode was basically some version of what if computers had consciousness? Like mm-hmm. that was like one whole season. That was the whole through like every episode ended. And it was like the moral was what if your computer programs were alive? Like and
mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of that in this episode. And I'm just like, look, I've already seen that like five times. On Blackbeard, at the end when she's about to destroy the quantum computer, it's like all the blood of these programs will be on your hands, and it's like I've already seen this Black Mirror. Like you don't need to do this again. So that was not particularly interesting to me. Here are some things about the episode I liked thematically. Right, this idea of that Netflix appeals to that Netflix and online appeals to the worst parts of you. To keep you engaged, right?
Okay.
The most base, darkest elements to keep you engaged. And that resonates with me a lot because we see a lot of that on every social media platform is like the stuff that gets the most engagement is like the most horrible stuff. And mm-hmm. I like that this nods to that. Obviously, we don't have that necessarily in the form of Netflix. Because like Netflix is not creating dynamic content for us. It has an algorithm and it has thumbnails personalized for us, but like it's not actually creating content yet for us that's personalized. And like dynamic, mm-hmm. on the fly generating content. And right. so that theme really resonated with me a lot. The other theme that I think was really interesting, this is kind of like I, David Chen, am bringing a lot to the table here, right? When it comes to this,
okay.
This theme is like what we have seen in the last year or two, especially with the rise of TikTok. I have witnessed it. I pay attention to this. Maybe a lot of people don't, but we've seen basically complete random strangers become like regular, ordinary people. They have no public life of any kind other than that they have a TikTok account. We've seen random people be thrust into the spotlight and have the details of their lives exposed for everyone to see.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just give like an example so like people know what we're talking about. But like this city bike thing is a great example. Like there's a white woman steals a black man's city bike in New York. The entire encounter is filmed. And now, like, all of their details are known to the public. Like, everyone's like, oh, my God. Like, you know, people, like, descend on these people and play armchair detective and put all the details of their lives out on the internet and, like, dissect everything that's going on with them. That's just, like, one recent example. But there's been, like, dozens of those examples of, like, somebody cuts someone off at an intersection and someone films it and puts it on TikTok, and now everyone's like identifying who they are and like exposing all the details of their lives. And like, how does that make one's life unlivable? I think something that this episode covers. So anyway, I've been going on for a bit, but those are some of the themes of this episode that like resonated with me a lot. Again, they're not like directly connected with the actual plot. They're just kind of like things that this episode made me think about that I think were pretty cool.
So like the TikTok stuff is like nonfiction doxing. It's not like YouTube celebrity stuff. Okay.
Yeah, it's both. It's all of them. You know, it happens on YouTube as well. So,
I think what I sort of liked about this episode, to your point of recreating portions of people's lives, is that we see a version of Joan's real life, right? And then we see how the recreation just amplifies and makes it extreme.
And distorts it.
Yeah, because there is like a baseline of the stuff that she's doing that you could say is bad, right? Like she doesn't deal with Sandy's firing very well.
Yeah.
It makes her uncomfortable. And then in the Joan is awful version of it, she's smug and catty. And then in the therapist's office, there is some kernel, I think, of like vulnerability to Annie Murphy's performance when she's talking about this relationship with her fiance that doesn't totally fulfill her. And then again, of course, in the Joan is awful version, it's very intensely dismissive of her partner. So I think to your point about like online reality and any kind of performative reality, taking like the worst aspects of things and just feeding them to be as bad as possible. I liked that the show sort of addressed that. I also, and we talked about this before, I just liked the little comments about like all the stuff we accept in our lives that we don't fully understand. Like your cell phone is always listening to you and spying on you.
Well,
and we've
okay.
just accepted that that's true.
I mean, I have
okay,
like
are
really.
Are you going to explain to me that it's not true?
I have really strong feelings about this. You'll notice that the, because I am of the belief that your smartphone is not always listening.
I think it is all the time.
I don't think it's listening. I don't think it's like recording what you're saying, and like even just storing that information on a database would be like unmanageable for most companies. I think the scary thing that we should be afraid of is not that Facebook is listening or Meta is listening to your phones and recording it and analyzing it. The scary thing is that they know what your preferences are without that. That's way more scary to me than that the idea that they're listening to your phone. In my opinion, I know this is very controversial because I tried to make this point on TikTok once, and I got people reported me for community guidelines violation. So, like, I'm very careful about making this point. But you will note, Roxana, that the episode went right up to the line of saying they're recording your thoughts, and then didn't go past that line.
I think it says that it's listening to you all the time, though, right? And watching you.
It says, "Hey, do you know how when you say a thing and then you see ads for the thing?" Well, that's how it knows. That it doesn't say it's listening. It doesn't say it's recording anything. It just implies, and you can fill in the blanks with whatever story you have. But I thought that was very clever. It doesn't outright state that it's recording anything. Because I personally don't think it is.
I would want to go back to the transcript and read that. Because my memory of the discussion with the lawyer is like, she is asking, how does it know what my home looks like? How does it know like where I'm sitting in my room and everything? And I thought that the lawyer says like, your phone is always on. It's always.
Yeah. She says your phone is always
you're doing.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, she says your phone is always on. And then, you know how when you're hanging out with your friends and you mention blah, and then you have ads for blah everywhere, but she doesn't actually articulate the mechanism by which that occurs. As far as I can recall. So
I think we should argue about this for like five to ten minutes.
Be the whole episode for sure.
This is the whole episode. Yeah, but regardless of how granular it gets, I always like that sort of, it feels very low lift, but I like it as a reminder of we trust all these things around us without fully understanding how they work. And I think that part of life is that, right? Like, I trust vaccines, I trust airplanes, I trust tons of things that I don't understand the science and math of. just because smarter people than me do understand and I trust them.
Yeah.
But there's sort of like an intimacy with your phone as something that holds like your voicemails and your photos and all this other stuff that's very close to you, that I think it's helpful to sort of be reminded that sometimes that stuff no longer belongs to you and it's just being used for like advertising, to your point.
Yeah.
So I liked that. I really liked Annie Murphy's performance.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
As Joan. I think she's great. I think not enough.
It's a fearless performance, you know? Like,
not enough people watched her in Kevin Can F Himself.
Yeah.
When she's doing this sort of like dark, unhappy, sort of unfulfilled character. And I really liked her going there.
She has a very plausible, like her reaction to what's going on, it feels very plausible to me, which is not something I can say for a lot of Black Mirror episodes. Like, we're like, oh, that person's. Yeah, go ahead.
There's like a good sense of like humor to what's happening, right? Like the show doesn't totally play this episode for doom and gloom, although some other Black Mirror episodes, as you said, are entirely doom and gloom.
Yeah.
So I like that there was some humor here and a little bit more lightness and sort of like people playing themselves or CG version of themselves quality that I think is fun. But how did you feel about the end? Did you like the destruction of the quantum computer and the sense that like everything's fine now?
Well, first of all, the vision of Netflix I thought was very funny. Like at the end, they infiltrate Streamberry and there is a woman in Streamberry named Mona Javadi, who I actually think is like a direct reference to a woman at Netflix. I think it's a reference to Bela Bajaria.
Oh, 100%.
Which is like just like, wow, like I can't believe you're like making it that personal, dude. Like, can you I'm sure Bela Bajaria like approved the, you know, like, or they had a conversation.
Sure.
You know, I don't think like this is the first time she's seeing this portrayal, but
no.
Can you imagine, it's like the pitch is like, "Hey, I want to make a version of you at this fake Netflix, and by the way, that person is going to be cruel, aloof, obsessed with engagement to the at the expense of our humanity." It's just like, wow, like pretty
you're
really hoping
you're
people
level,
get that. Yeah, go ahead.
I think when you're at that level of success, like, why would she care?
Well, she's not
cashing her checks.
She's not like a super like public figure though. Like, you know,
oh, I think she is.
People like you and me know who Bela Bajaria is, but I don't know that like average person on the street knows who Bela Bajaria is. Anyway, so
No. I'm sure that the average person on the street, but see, I think that's the power of it though, right? Like, not enough people know that it's a reference, so it's not actively harmful.
Yeah.
If you do know that it's a reference, we can sort of laugh at it like we're doing now, but she's still cashing a lot of checks, right? It's like,
I think
at a certain level of wealth and fame and power, like, who cares about the satire?
Yeah.
But yes, I think she's very clearly a reference. She had, if you want to know more about her, she had a New Yorker profile, right? And she had a lot of quotes this week that went viral when she was sort of talking about like the Netflix method. Of streaming drops rather than weekly binges and like the algorithm and data. And she's very good at saying things that don't entirely check out because we don't have the data to check them out. But yes, so it ends with her in front of this screen of all the like dynamic shows that Streamberry is creating.
I mean, first of all, she's very talent hostile, apparently, because she's like, tell Selma Hayek Pino to F off. And then she's like, yes, I've created a blank is awful out of everyone. And by the way, people like the is awful because it's very like Agent Smith from The Matrix. Like, we tried to make a happy version of The Matrix, but
it didn't work.
Humans rejected it. Entire crops were lost because people can't take being happy. Instead, they need this negative version of themselves to keep them engaged. Which is, again, it feels very true to life to me about what humans want in their entertainment. So then Annie Murphy starts like destroying this quantum computer. She's about to access quantum computer. And we find out that we are actually not in base reality. We're actually in a simulated reality where Annie Murphy is playing Joan. And then Selma Hayek-Pino is playing Annie Murphy. And it's like, oh, right. And it's a kind of a reference to the idea that we're living in a simulation, I think. Like, and it's a fun goof. I would describe it as a fun goof. It's not like super thought-provoking or anything like that. It's just like, oh, that's a fun little curveball to throw in at the end. And I'm sorry, what was your question? Like, what did I think of the ending?
How did you feel about it? Did you find it effective? Because I don't know if I necessarily found the simulation stuff that effective.
Well, the idea is that they destroy it, and then that allows Annie Murphy and Joan to actually have a real-life friendship. And also, by the way, Joan gives up her job at a tech company and decides to pursue her true passion of starting a cafe, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what it is.
That's nice. It's like, it's sort of cozy. It's cute. Yeah, it's like the nicest Black Mirror ending.
Yeah, it's like a pat ending where, like, we destroyed the machine and now we can move on with our lives, basically.
Right.
And so
I almost expected a final twist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That undid that happy ending. But overall, it was fine. And probably my favorite thing about it is tied to something which we might talk about right now as you try to transition us to the next part of this conversation.
Well, K-Sex in the chat says, did you notice that the aspect ratio was kind of letterboxed up until the end when we get to see the full real Joan and the screen fills up? I don't know if you caught that, but the show plays around with letterboxed and aspect ratios throughout the season. So I think it is worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah.
Anything else about Joan is awful?
Ben Barnes. That's what I would say.
Ben Barnes is in the episode for about 30 seconds. He plays like Rob Delaney on, you know,
on Streamberry
level two, and kisses Selma Hayek. You know, can you imagine, like, Ben Barnes is living the dream? Okay, it's like, hey, we're gonna pay you $2,000 to show up today. And you have to do 8 takes where you kiss Selma Hayek, Pino, and that's that's your whole day. Yeah. It's like, wow, like,
that's work.
Can you imagine the life? We should all be so lucky. I thought Selma Hayek, Pino, was hilarious in this episode. Like, her interaction with a lawyer was very funny. Annie Murphy storming into the church and crapping on the floor. It's just like a fun, it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I don't know that I would have gone immediately to that level, like right after, you know, like I would have probably tried to escalate it a little bit before doing that level. But
why escalate? Just go to 100.
Just go to 100 right away.
As quickly as you can.
You know, but yeah. And yeah, overall, I quite liked it. It's solid Black Mirror. It's thought-provoking. It makes you think about, like, what are the ways in which our lives are put out in public for people to dissect? What are the ways in which this technology, like, we've already seen deepfake technology being used to create, you can create a beer commercial on the fly. You can create a movie on the fly now. And it's like, how is that technology going to be used in the future? There is a whole strain of thinking that says, hey, in the future, you'll be able to put yourself into, imagine being able to put yourself into Avengers Endgame, and like, generate it dynamically. And it's like, there's a lot of like tech bros who like fantasize about this. And I don't have that fantasy. Like, I don't want to see myself. I barely want to see myself in this decoding TV stuff. I don't want to see myself in, like, you know, any of my popular entertainment, but like, this is a great exploration of that idea. Like, if we actually put people into entertainment, what might that look like? What shape might that take? I like that this episode goes into that and what the consequences would be. It wouldn't take place like this, you know, like, there would be an outrage. Joan would be able to sue. The T's and C's would be, Vulture would have covered the T's and C's way before anything like this happened, you know, like, but
I think you're being very hopeful. I could 100% see some like crap like this happening. If only because I think the idea of licensing, which we haven't talked about a lot, but I think the idea of licensing is what's really interesting here. Is like, at a certain level, if you have given your approval and your permission, like, people can do a lot of stuff, right? It's less about like using AI to just insert yourself into stuff and giving companies the explicit permission to do so. Which I think is like the more frightening part of it. But it's a lot of like solid sci-fi ideas that are sort of thrown out in this episode. And they don't have to have answers, right? Like, Black Mirror asks a lot of questions that it never answers. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good way to start the season.
On that last point, you know, there is, for instance, this like TikTok program where you can make ads for companies and you can make money this way. So you're like, I shoot an ad, I'm in the ad, and then the company uses it, and then I make money, right? Like, it's not a bad way to make money. But once you shoot that ad, the company basically can use your image probably forever.
Of course. Like, of course.
And so it's like 10 years from now, do you still want to be advertising, you know, scrub-a-dub-dub sponges or whatever the heck? You know, like, right. I think people give up their rights and image likeness rights and images in a way that they don't fully comprehend. Mm-hmm. And I do think you bring up the good point that this episode does bring that up. So, mm-hmm. Solid episode. Joan is awful. Any favorite quotes from the episode, Roxana? I had a favorite quote where Mona Javadi, the Streamberry executive, talks about mesmerized horror. She's talking about how, like, emphasizing the negative elements of people's lives creates mesmerized horror, which really drives engagement, which I thought was very, very funny.
The tonality of that was really funny.
Very good. Also, the way that she kind of casually drops, like, oh, yeah, we're going to release the one with you in it this Friday. And then, like, the person she's interviewing is like, oh, yeah, great. That's awesome. Love that for me. You know, like, that was a great moment. Yeah.
I initially was like, I don't necessarily, my nationalism made me say that I don't love that she, like, is clearly Middle Eastern. But at the same time, you know, tech is evil and boundaryless. my favorite quote was, I really like when Michael Cera just randomly shows up as the tech guy. And I like that the guy is like, I'm not Michael Cera. Like, Michael Cera just licensed his face.
Right. Which is a very, that's a very mind-blowing moment where you're like, wait, Michael Cera is self-aware? You know, like, that's a cool moment.
Michael Cera has been self-aware for a long time, I think.
Sure.
In his performances.
But in the context of the show, you know?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So. Yes, I really enjoyed that. There were other moments that were very funny. I don't know if they were quote-worthy, but there are a lot of amusing moments, like, after the first episode airs, when people are sort of interrogating how they come off during the show. That was amusing. And I liked, we're going to watch television in a bar. Yes, we're going to watch television in a bar. I liked that.
that was awesome.
That was good as well.
That was awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, those are some thoughts on Joan is Awful.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let's get to episode 2, Lock Henry.
Yeah.
Overall thoughts, Roxana? Like, should people watch this one? Do you think it's good? What do you think?
I think I really liked this one. I think the reveal to me was a little bit less surprising than the final reveal in the first episode. But I thought this was really fun in terms of how it played with, like, different kinds of true crime and documentary tropes. I like that the episode integrates the kind of style that it's mocking. I did find it disturbing, which I think we like in Black Mirror, right? Like, we want to be a little freaked out. And I liked the sort of open-ended nature of the ending. After the first episode had a very, like, tie the bow, close the loop sort of end, I like that this one is just sort of an unsettling open door. So I don't know if I want to be as bold as to say I liked it more than the first episode. I might be that bold.
Wow.
And say that I liked it more than the first episode. I mean, it's genre. It was fun.
It's genre. I think here's how I feel about episode 2. I like the point it's making. It's a great point. The episode itself is just fine. You know, there's no
just
There's no sci-fi.
Is it because Josh Hartnett isn't in it? Is that why?
Yeah, that's right.
There's no Josh. That's what I thought.
There's a startling lack of Hartnett in the episode. There is no, basically no sci-fi elements at all, if I recall correctly. Like, there's it is basically a takedown of the true crime industrial complex.
Yeah. And, can I say a spoiler alert, though? Like, this season increasingly moves away from sci-fi. So I do think if you're sort of down with the shift in this episode, I think you'll enjoy the rest of the season.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, I'm sorry.
I'm not saying I need sci-fi, but like, I don't know, like even like mild sci-fi is good. You know, like one of my favorite ones is what is it? The one with the memory one, right? Like the entire history of you, you know, that's like, what if there was one invention that was just integrated into everyone's life, you know, that, and it's like, something like that could happen in the near future. It's not like, we're in flying cars and everything. It's just, you know, and
it's not the Jetsons, but it's little
like light
bit
sci-fi
of
is like, but like, and then there was that one, but you know, then you can get more extreme where it's like, the one with, is it Bryce Dallas Howard? Was she in it? Or
I
is
think
it
that's one?
You know, where
is it her?
Something dive, nose dive, or whatever. Now I need to make sure I didn't confuse it.
Yeah, now you need to look because I don't remember.
Nose dive with Bryce Dallas Howard. You know, that's like society has reorganized itself around social points. It's like that's like hardcore. So I'm okay being light sci-fi, but you know, I'm hoping for something like that, but. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. We'll see when we cover the rest of the shows. So, it's basically one point made pretty well. That's kind of what I see episode two as, right?
That's such damning praise.
The genre elements of like this is a, so yeah. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. So anyway, overall, I thought it was decent. It's not necessarily why I tuned into Black Mirror, you know, but it's not bad. And again, it is I think a damning indictment of Netflix. So I always will go in for that. Okay, so let's talk about what happens in the episode. Davis, who's played by Samuel Blenken, and his girlfriend Pia, played by Mahala Harold, visit Davis's mother Monica in the remote. Mother Janet, played by Monica Dolan. Yeah. Let me start over. Davis and his girlfriend Pia visit Davis's mother Janet in the remote Scottish town of Loch Henry. Davis and Pia are there to shoot a documentary about an egg vigilante, I think. but a visit to the local pub reveals that Loch Henry has also been the home of a serial killer named Ian Adair. Adair previously killed many tourists and even shot Davis's father, who later died of a MRSA infection as a result. Pia immediately gravitates towards Adair as a much more exciting and marketable subject for their documentary. The two set upon making a new documentary about Adair. One night, while Pia is digitizing some of Janet's old videotapes, she realizes that Davis's mother and father were partners in crime with Adair, participating in the murders along with him. Pia tries to escape but dies after falling into a body of water. Meanwhile, Janet unearths a bunch of evidence that she was one of the murderers, leaves it on her kitchen table, and writes a suicide note to Davis before killing herself. As the episode ends, we see that Davis has won a BAFTA for his work on the documentary about the episode's events, and that Loch Henry's once dormant nightlife scene is alive once again thanks to the documentary's popularity. So, that's what happens in the episode.
Yeah. I will acquiesce one thing to you, which is that I think a well-known serial killer, even without a documentary, that place would have true crime tourists. Like, I think it would already be a source of fascination.
Right. Sure.
You know,
I see. You're saying that that's a negative component of the episode. Like that's
yeah. Like I'm saying there's enough true crime mania online, like message boards and communities and Facebook groups and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That I think people would have already sort of been aware of this and would have turned it into like a tourist destination. It's in Europe. It's beautiful. People go to Europe all the time.
what you don't know, Roxana, is Loch Henry takes place in a universe where Reddit doesn't exist. So I think the genre elements are like fine. They're not bad. Like her Janet like making the shepherd's pie and like them being creepily alone in the house, I like how Pia just can't say the right thing next to around Janet. Like, mm-hmm. she keeps stumbling into these social faux pas. That's like a very nice dynamic. Like, we've all been there where we're like mm-hmm. with someone, a significant other's parent, and we just can't say the right thing. Mm-hmm. I like
Janet as well, asking where Pia is originally from. There's also, it goes both ways, right? Yeah, it's like the yeah. awkward girlfriend dynamic and the like slightly out of touch, fumbling, awkward mother character who arguably is somewhat of a performance. We find out by the
yeah.
end.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's a way to, we sort of talked about this with Succession, where Tom's like fumbling Midwesternness sort of becomes like a veil of his actual nefariousness.
Mm, yeah.
I sort of think we get that with Janet, where it's like, oh, she's just like a nice old lady who actually was revealed to be part of like a weird sexual murderous group. But yeah, like, I think yeah. the horror genre stuff is good. And I think to me, the documentary methodology stuff is better, where it's like there is a discussion within the episode between Davis and Pia about like what makes a watchable documentary, like what does a commercial documentary include? And we hear it's like a lot of landscape shots, a lot of like focus on how beautiful yeah. this small town or this small community is. And then we get those elements integrated within the episode, right? You get all these beautiful shots of what Scotland looks yeah. like. You get the main street, you get the pub. So I like that it is very self-referential in sort of a smart way. Even before you get to the end of the episode where they basically play the trailer of what this documentary looked like. But yeah, I mean, like, thematically, yes, there is a lot less to discuss because it's not doing sci-fi stuff.
Yeah.
It's really just about like, what have we come to expect from true crime and what are the ways that it becomes predictable? And is that predictability good or bad?
That's interesting that I think everything you're saying is right. That's not the components of the episode that stick out to me. You know, like,
oh, interesting.
I think it is a deconstruction of not only you point out very, very eloquently. It's a deconstruction of true crime as like a format,
mm-hmm.
but also it's a deconstruction of the business of true crime. You know, that,
of course.
Those are the yeah. scenes that stick out the most for me is when he's trying to sell the documentary to Historic, which I think is kind of a TLC History Channel style, style analog and
no,
the reason
well it's not a channel, it's like a production company, right?
Sure, but I guess yeah. like the final documentary, the way it's presented is very TLC-esque in my opinion. It's very like, and you know, the woman that was behind it the whole time, and then they're playing like her quotes, which is like very clever, like the way they like put in all mm-hmm. her quotes to make it feel like she's evil the whole time, like foreshadowing quotes, which I thought was you know, a nice moment when they play that all again.
Mm-hmm.
Probably my favorite part of the episode is when you like you recontextualize all of her quotes as though she is the killer. It makes yes. a lot more sense.
Yes.
But you know, they're pitching her the show. She's like, "Well, I already kind of know who Ian Adair is. Like, what's the angle?" And he's like, "Well, mm-hmm. My father died, and mm-hmm. also we can go into the crime scene, which they don't legally have access to, and they're
well Pia, it's what interesting yeah. is Pia is the one in that conversation who is pushing that stuff, right? Like at
yeah,
that
yeah.
point,
well, he's kind of like going along with her, you know,
he's along with it, but he's like initially uncomfortable about the idea of like involving himself in the documentary, which I think is
right.
of course like a commentary on like what did documentary filmmaking used quote unquote to be versus what is it now, which is like looking for a personal hook, looking for something that is sellable, looking for a way to make like
yeah.
6 to 8 episodes of something. Is anybody going to watch the Egg Vigilante documentary?
Right.
Right. Like, will they get funding for that?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
is it murder that sells? And like, it's usually murder that sells.
True crime cannot be separated from commerce, right?
Correct.
And that is unfortunate. But another... You know, arguably one of the most chilling scenes from the episode is the very end. Two moments from the end of the episode really stick out to me, right? One is the woman from Historic giving the speech, which just feels so fake because it's like, and it's so important that we got Davis to tell a story. And it's like, we saw earlier on, you didn't really give a crap about, you know, like you only gave a crap about how marketable it was. You didn't care about this as like an important story to tell. So, and then she's like, oh, I hate this person. Hey, by the way, do you want to be, appear as Pia in the, in the, you know, narrative version of it? You know, like it makes you fake. Being in Hollywood, being around show business makes you more fake. And that, movie executive at Historic was like a really great way of cutting that kind of character down, which I thought was just like really smart. But then all the people at the pub wearing the Janet mask.
Yeah, like knockoffs of her red mask.
Yeah. Is a great way of, because basically she wore this mask when she murdered or tortured these people. And true crime dehumanizes people. You know, it makes real life people feel like they, people take, the thing that's so insidious about true crime is the people who are obsessed with true crime and like actively participate in trying to solve the crime or whatever, posting on message boards or whatever, they dehumanize people because they think of them as characters in a play as opposed to actual human beings. And the thing that's most insidious about it is it's under the guise of justice. Like they feel like they're doing the right thing. We're doing some good for the world by ruining these innocent people's lives. You know, often in the case, it's like dragging these things out of the past for our entertainment. I think a lot of, not all, but I think a lot of true crime is a truly net negative for humanity personally, but that's me, you know? So, yeah, so I resonate a lot with what the show is trying to say.
Right. Interesting. I am not that harsh on true crime. I think that there are genuinely good things that can come out of providing investigations and attention to crimes that the police have not provided resources to. I think that we see that a lot. So I don't want to discount the fact that like people who consider themselves like investigators or in Yellow Jackets parlance, citizen detectives, I think that they can do good things. So I don't want to like write off the genre entirely. I just think to your larger point, like making something commercial and making it entertainment is bad for everything. I don't think it's just true crime, you know, that like necessarily has been negatively impacted by that. So what's funny is that like the stuff that stuck out to you is the stuff to me that was the most like, yeah, of course this show would say that like an executive is two-faced. Like obviously who is surprised by that detail, you know? The stuff that I found more compelling was doing the genre stuff really well. Like I like them breaking into the house where these murders were committed and having like their Blair Witch moment, where they bring along lemon juice to like fake bloodstains or black lights, and then they turn it off and the entire place is like coated with blood anyway. Like I like the fact that we could do a horror story that yes had like a broader message, but the broader message for me was a little bit like, yeah, I know your horror stuff is more intriguing than your broader message. This episode felt a little bit like, I don't know, thematically slightly underwhelming with the Hollywood stuff. But I really liked the ending and the fact that like Davis got what he wanted. Like his mom knew what he needed for his documentary and knew what he needed to be successful. So like in that way, he is a success. But he also lost everything. So I think that's the point that it comes closest to what you're trying to say, right? That in this search for success, again, you like sacrifice parts of yourself that you might not have anticipated. And is the trade-off worth it?
Yeah.
I think that's sort of the lingering question.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is a lot of Black Mirror lingering questions is right. The trade-off worth it? So I liked this spin on it. But I can understand if you were looking for a sci-fi story, this might not be so effective.
I agree. And I think great point at the end. The mother's note really was moving to me. You know, she's mm-hmm. like, hey, I have obviously murdered and tortured people, but I'm still going to do one nice thing for my son.
Right.
That was kind of moving for me. I will say, you know, one of the parts of the episode that was like kind of unrealistic, you know, we haven't talked about the realism of these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. But I have to say, Roxana, in episode one, Joan is awful. The idea that Joan, a white woman dating an Indian guy, and he makes food that isn't flavorful enough, that did not track for me at all. It's like,
I almost feel like that's like a reverse stereotype. Like, what if in cooking, like, we don't know his entire background. We don't know maybe if his parents were like very assimilated and did not.
Gotta check my biases. Gotta check my biases.
Yeah, we don't
apparently know. Apparently in the Black Mirror future, like, Indian food is not passed down from generation to generation as effectively as it is in our universe.
Well, I think what we're assuming is that someone will always cook food from their ethnicity, which is not necessarily true. And can be like its
own. I'm not even necessarily assuming that. I'm assuming that, okay. Like, you know, I think that from my, you know, general understanding, mm-hmm. a lot of, I'll just say from my experience as an East Asian person, like, mm-hmm. the flavor profile is often a pretty strong one, pretty intense one, you know?
For sure.
So anyway. In terms of realism, it's like the scene when Pia is watching the videotape. It's like, mm-hmm. dude, I know you're like extremely scared, but like maybe turn down the frickin' volume a little bit and don't have your back to the door. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of those kinds of things that happen in Black Mirror where it's like characters behaving completely nonsensically.
Of course.
Happens. Well, not, I mean, you know, yeah.
You could extend that with, why does she need to like forge the river? She was doing a good job hiding from Janet, like, behind a gigantic yeah. rock. She did yeah. not need to pass a moving body of water.
It comes to having a protagonist that like behaves irrationally, I don't think Mark yes. Henry overcame that. You know,
I think that's fair. Yeah, I could see that. I also think at the same time, though, like, there are things that are very realistic to me. Like Davis hanging up on Stuart when Stuart calls and is like, hey, the pub is full. Like, yeah. congratulations. Like, that doesn't matter to Davis right now. I also really liked that performance because it's the guy who played Podrick Payne in Game of Thrones.
Oh,
and it's
shit.
So different.
Oh, it's so different. He's like this kind mm-hmm. of
he's like this sort of like yeah. braggadocious, bro-y, vaguely right-wing small yeah. business owner.
Yeah,
it's very different. Amazing.
All right, yeah. All right. Just for that alone, it gets a few extra points in my book.
Does it? So. Okay, well, that's good. I'm sorry. So again, he's not Josh Hartnett, but yeah. he does do a good job, I
thank
thought.
Thank you for that, Roxana.
You're welcome.
So, anyway, like the point that this is making, some really great moments in it. Mm-hmm. Certainly not a bad episode, but it's kind of like, not why I tune into Black Mirror. We'll see what mm-hmm. the rest of the season holds. Those are our thoughts on episodes 1 and 2 of season 6 of Black Mirror. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Again, if you want to support the show, become a free or paid member at decodingtv.com. Sign up for the email list if you're free, but if you become a paid member, you're directly contributing to making sure Decoding TV keeps on going. We got a lot of stuff coming out for you in the next few weeks. The Bear, we got Silo coming for you, and potentially more. Going to be a packed summer full of TV shows. So be sure to keep it tuned in to podcast.decodingtv.com or subscribe at youtube.com/decodingtv and you'll get notifications whenever we go live. Roxana Haddadi, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can just find me at Vulture, and I might write about Black Mirror. I might not, but I am here for these conversations and I'm enjoying them. So thank you guys for listening.
All right. See you on the next one. Episode 3 is what we'll be covering next here on Decoding TV. Goodbye.
Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.